Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. And in the most recent Florida Phoenix column from Craig Pittman, FloridaPhoenix.com, you're talking about one of the real danger points of the legislative session, as far as I'm concerned, and that's an attempt to offer mitigation to developers who destroy seagrass beds.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're in sort of a seagrass crisis right now. We've killed tens of thousands of acres of seagrass. Our manatees are starving as a result. And so the legislature's solution is, let's let developers kill even more seagrass, as long as they promise to make it up by turning over public lands, these publicly owned bay bottoms and so forth, to private companies to build mitigation banks where they would promise they would plant more seagrass to make up for the seagrass that got destroyed. And it's like, so you're giving a private company permission to use public land to try and fix what's been broken on other public land by other private companies. It's just crazy. And so I watched a couple of the committee meetings where they were discussing these bills. The first one I watched in the Senate sponsor couldn't even explain the bill and called up a lobbyist for the Mitigation Bankers Association to explain it.
Imagine that. I mean, this is a representative essentially abdicating her responsibility to defend, define, and explain the bill to a lobbyist.
Yeah. And it's outrageous.
Again,
it's a one-page bill. And it had an amendment on it that would include not just seagrass, but would include coral reefs and oyster reefs too, which boggles the mind.
The idea that it's one for one, like with a seagrass bed or coral reef. Well, if you destroy an acre here, you can just put an acre there and it's all the same. It doesn't work that way.
And so then in the House subcommittee, one of the people who testified was a scientist from Friends of Biscayne Bay and said, look, from my experience, you can't plant seagrass where it doesn't already grow. It fails. It's not growing there for a reason. Mm-hmm. So the idea of building a mitigation bank full of seagrass where there's not already seagrass growing, it's just not going to work.
Yeah.
And one of the senators said, but we're going to put smart people in charge of it. You know, like that will overcome the impossibility of it.
Sadly, that was one of my representatives from Northeast Florida, Aaron Bean. But seagrass is like rainforest or any other ecological habitat specific to an area. It doesn't grow everywhere. It needs specific conditions. And you have a great deal of experience with the failure of these mitigation banks and mitigation ideas from your Paving Paradise book, which was all about wetlands and trying to mitigate wetlands. Well, you destroy 5 acres here, we can make up for it with 5 acres there.
Yeah. Or we'll destroy 5 acres here, but we'll make up for it by preserving 5 acres. So that means in effect, you've spent a dollar and you've saved, you haven't spent 50 cents. So that's a net gain. No, that's not how that works. You've lost a dollar, you know? But that's not the way they count it on paper. That's that whole trickeration language of preservation versus enhancement versus, you know, it's just crazy.
You can read the article in the show notes or at FloridaPhoenix.com. A very dangerous, bad bill. And it has plenty of company in this session of the Florida legislature. Craig was up by me in Amelia Island and signing books at Story and Song. But while you were here, we came up with a number of ideas for future podcast episodes. And one of those was about circus history. And that ties into our sponsor, Visit Sarasota. And I was researching some of the Sarasota circus history. And in 1927, the Ringlings set up their winter headquarters, essentially, for the circus in Sarasota. And in 1997, the National Circus School for Performing Arts was founded, and that continues to operate today. Now, they've got programs and events, which you'd expect, but I didn't realize they actually had classes down there. If you want to learn acrobatics or the trapeze or trampoline, you can actually take courses and classes and learn from the professionals. One of the many wonderful activities offered in Sarasota, that's at circusarts.org. Visit sarasota.com to learn all about the activities and events, outdoor, indoor, concerts, culture, dining, shopping that is available to visitors to Sarasota, whether you're looking for a weekend getaway or your next family vacation. I'm sure the kids would love to get on the trapeze and bounce around on the trampoline at the National Circus School for the Performing Arts. You can find all about that at visitsarasota.com. That takes us to this week's guest, and that is Craig Hegel. Craig is a professor at the University of Tampa, professor at St. Pete College, formerly with the University of Florida. He's got over 30 years experience in native plant education, restoration, gardening. He's an author, and he's going to talk to us today about wildflowers.
That's right. So we go from growing seagrass to growing wildflowers, which is a much happier topic.
It certainly is, but it's all part of that great biodiversity in Florida, and Craig is one of the absolute leading experts on the subject.
Craig, it's such a pleasure having another Craig on the podcast today. Now, you've written quite a few books. How many books have you written so far?
Six.
Your book on Florida wildflowers, I think, is a really helpful one. Tell people a little bit about why Florida has so many wildflowers. And in fact, Florida has an official state wildflower. So please mention that too.
You'll get a kick out of the latter part, though, I'm sure, with your sense of humor. But, you know, Florida could not really pick a wildflower, so they picked a genus. That way it covers them for about over a dozen species that do occur here in the state. And the original license plate had the one that wasn't native on it for the first
time. Oh, my God, you're kidding.
I know. Another Florida story, right?
Yes.
Florida does have a huge variety of wildflowers. You know, La Florida basically means land of flowers. And although Florida is flat, we have the third greatest diversity of native plants in any state in the nation, which is kind of, I don't know, I find that pretty fascinating when you look at California and Texas and the fact they got deserts and mountains and oceans and all kinds of relief. And we've got 40-foot elevation or something, but we just have a wide variety of habitats and interesting geologic history, which we won't go into unless you force me to, but it has created this incredible diversity of flowering plants.
Is it a function of all of the rain that we get too? Does that help?
You know, it does to some extent, but you know, we have deserts here, but they get lots of rain. So they're, you know, the Florida scrub system, for example, is essentially a desert that gets a lot of rain. So we have these really poor, droughty soils, but this really incredible, interesting collection of plants that grow in that kind of system. And, you know, we have fairly fertile soils, and we've got North Florida with the hills and some clays that creep over from Georgia. We got remnants of Appalachia up around the Torrey State Park area. We've got, you know, these coastal beach communities and lime rock at the surface, and all that kind of combines to make these real diversity of growing conditions. Not so much the rain, but the soils and the nearness to the water table, whether it floods in the summer and the rainy season is affected by where the limestone is, all those kind of things come into play.
Looping back to Craig's first question, what is the Florida state wildflower that is actually a genus that was not native but now is on the license plate?
It's Coreopsis, which is sometimes the common one is called common tick seed.
And that's a yellow flower, a narrow flower with a small bloom for folks who are wondering, that is seen growing around most of the state, some in landscapes and yards, but a lot just by roadsides and disturbed areas and as well as natural areas as well.
Yep. Common tick seed is a very common plant statewide. We've got one pink one. All the others are yellow. We have a few endemic ones that are only found in Florida that are relatively rare. It's a common genus.
How many of our wildflowers are considered to be rare?
Oof. You know, there's over 300 native plants that are listed as threatened or endangered in the state.
Wow.
Now, that includes some trees and shrubs, of course, too. And I've never really broken it down by wildflowers. And of course, the term wildflower is a little nebulous in the sense that we have all kinds of beautiful flowering trees and shrubs, but technically they're not wildflowers, at least not in my mind. We're talking about herbaceous plants and things that don't produce wood. I should make it clear for folks that don't understand the word herbaceous. Some of my students don't.
How did you get into the subject of Florida's native wildflowers? What brought you to that?
That's a good question. You know, I grew up as a little kid in Madison, Wisconsin. My parents always gave me a garden. I always had a little part of the yard I could grow stuff, and I'd get my little burpee catalog in the mail, you know, back in the old days when you had to mail away for things, and it would come and I'd find a couple of things and I'd grow them in the garden. And I just always loved flowers, but I really wasn't a botany oriented person like a lot of people think I must have been. I didn't know one thing from another for the most part. You know, over time, learned to appreciate the value of wildflowers, mostly from my background as a wildlife biologist and the fact that, you know, when I came to UF, hired to be an urban wildlife specialist, one of the things people seemed to want to do, the interest that was starting to grow, was butterflies and how do I get butterflies in my yard. And so it just all kind of grew from that, my need as a wildlife biologist to be able to tell people what they can plant native to Florida, both for birds and other things and for butterflies. And that started growing into wildflowers and my natural interest in the thing, and just kind of become more and more of a botany guy as I've gotten older in this state.
Yeah, many of Craig's books focus on the connection between native plants and the animals that need them to survive, birds, butterflies, different things like that. In his time at, and I'll include links to those books in the show notes if you're interested in ordering those. And in your time at Florida, the University of Florida, you developed the Florida Backyard Friendly Landscaping Program. I know I have the verbiage wrong, but tell people a little bit about that statewide program, which encourages the use of native or at least Florida-friendly plants as opposed to so many of the decorative and invasive plants we find around Florida.
Well, you know, when I hired for this new program, it was funded through the non-game program of the Florida Game and Fish Commission. So we worked closely with them, and they were interested, to be quite honest, in kind of dumping the urban wildlife portion of their non-game program onto the university. And people at the university that ended up hiring us were interested in taking it on. So, you know, I was hired to work in Central Florida. Part of what they wanted us to do was to be able to work with homeowners on how to solve wildlife problems like squirrels in my yard and things eating my plants and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, we decided early on we also wanted a component that would help people understand how to make their yards, their home landscapes more attractive to attract wildlife. And so that's where it came out of. The National Wildlife Federation had this program about backyard habitats, and we kind of built on that. But Florida is so different than the rest of the country in terms of, you know, not so much the basic landscape style, use native plants, have trees, do this, but the plants they were suggesting and the approach they had really didn't fit well with Florida. So we took it upon ourselves to start developing publications and talks and programs that were geared more towards wildlife, and we certified yards as Florida wildlife habitats, much like the National Wildlife Federation was doing, and it kind of grew from that point.
Did you know that family travel has the incredible power to shape our children's worldview and create lasting memories? In a world where representation is often lacking, it's essential for our children to see themselves reflected in every aspect of life, including the stories we tell about travel. Introducing the Travel of Legacy podcast, where we're rewriting the script by celebrating the diverse voices of Black and Brown family travelers. Each episode of Travel of Legacy is a testament to the enriching power and the joy of exploration in Black and Brown communities. So journey with us and subscribe now.
One of the difficulties people have, and Craig is something of a legend in some of my circles, as I'm a member of the Florida Native Plant Society, my local ICSIA chapter here in Northeast Florida, so named after one of those endangered or rare Florida native wildflowers, the Bartram's ICSIA. But when people ask me, you know, what plants should I plant? You know, I want to plant more natives. I want to draw more butterflies, birds, that kind of thing. It's a difficult question to answer in Florida because there are so many different habitats here. And whether you have salt spray or very dry conditions, very wet conditions, shade all the time, you know, water inundation, North Florida gets freezes, South Florida obviously doesn't. I'm sure you get the question all the time, but there really isn't a blanket answer for someone in Florida to, you know, what native plants should I plant in my landscape?
No, that's absolutely true. You know, people want things to be easy. So they want me to give them a list of 10 plants. They put that in their yard and they've got what they want. And I like to challenge people to say, you know, what do you want? What are your goals? You know, give me the set of goals that you're trying to accomplish. Do you want more birds? Do you want more bees? Where do you live? What kind of things interest you? And then, you know, the books basically came out of that from things I had written when I was at the university to try to allow people to choose what they want, because it's your landscape, you know? And for me as an outsider, I hate it when people want me to come over to the yard and then give them a list of what they should plant. What I want to do is say, here are things you could use, and these are the attributes they have. That's in the books. And then you decide what you want. And because there's lots of choices, like you said, even the fact that we have such diverse growing conditions, even that still gives you dozens and dozens of possibilities for a shade tree or a flowering understory tree shrub that might be ornamental. It also has bird value. Florida is a fascinating state. It's a great place to work in. It gives you a whole lot of freedom. But to be honest, some people don't really want that freedom. They want somebody to tell them what to do. And I get frustrated by that, I'll be honest, because I think we all have a different set of aesthetics. We all have different goals. We all might want to achieve the same kind of thing, but we can approach it differently. We have that ability to do that in Florida with so many plants to choose from. I really would like to encourage people to use their own creativity to some extent and not just rely on somebody's list of the 10 best plants. Yeah. I see those lists all the time. They drive me crazy.
Right. Because those 10 best lists are not individualized like you talked about. And if you get like me here, there's one side of my house that gets heavy wind. I'm a block from the beach. So wildflowers don't really grow there because they're too fine and delicate. And I get a nor'easter come through here and it whips them all to the ground. I learned that from experience. I also have heavy shade here. And I know one of your books deals specifically with shady areas. Here in North Florida, we get freezes and some of those plants aren't going to, you know, take it through the freeze or the salt spray. Right. So, there are solutions for everyone. Unfortunately, because this isn't, you know, Ohio or someplace where it's essentially the same top to bottom, you really do need to put a little extra effort in, unfortunately, to find the plants that will thrive in your landscape, because there's nothing more frustrating than going through all this work and planting all this stuff and spending all this money. And then the plants are we've all had that happen.
Yeah, and I've killed more plants than probably anyone in the state over time. You know, I like to tell people say, well, you know, I tried that once and it died. God, I tried it 4 or 5 times before I got one to live. You know, that's never the answer. Is I tried it, it died. Did you put it in the right spot? Is it really the right plant? But it was just in the wrong location. Was it just a bad plant? You know, I mean, sometimes we buy a plant, it looks pretty healthy, but if you really were to examine the root system and all the rest of that, you might find out that it's really not a very well-grown plant to begin with. There are so many reasons a plant will die. Wildflower tree, it doesn't really matter. So we have to take a little bit of time to understand our site conditions. It's so important. Like you said, you know, and where I used to live before I moved up here into Pasco County, you know, I have this little wildflower nursery here I dabble with for fun. I grow things that most people don't grow. It gives people a chance to buy a few things they might want that nobody else is really dealing with. I don't want to cut into the profit margin of real people trying to make a living. But all that said, you know, my little nursery in the side yard in the summer is full sun, but in the wintertime when the sun is low, the house I was living in and then the house next door to the other side on the south side of my house would block it. There'd be no sunlight at all. You know, things change over time and people really need to live in a place for a while and see if their yard has places that might flood a little bit during the year. If the place is shadier this time of year than that, what trees do I have that might be obstacles because the root system's so close to the surface? And when you understand your growing conditions, then you can make a list or whittle down your list of what might work well. And once you've done all that, which I think is fun, some people may find it too challenging. It's really not. If you just take a little bit of time, use your own sense of aesthetics, et cetera, then, you know, you're way more likely to succeed. And so many people in the native plant movement, you know, they find religion. All of a sudden, they're this this disciple of native plantness, and they want to convert their entire yard today into native plants and rip out everything they've got. And no, Jesus, no, take your time, learn something about what you've got to work with, set some goals, and take little pieces at a time you can actually work with, because there is nothing more frustrating than biting off this giant chunk, finding out you've bitten more than you can chew, and then you go back to the way you used to do things because it was easier, and we've lost another person that might have made an ecological difference in this world.
Sure, and then you're one of those suckers that you see on TV with the home remodeling project, really attempting to take on the entire house by themselves, and they're $100,000 in debt. The house is totally upside down with construction debris. I think the best advice you gave people, and it's how I started, a little 10 by 10 foot area. I'm going to work on this and see how that works. And it gradually expanded. And I don't have much of a side yard here. It might be 60, 70 feet long by 10 feet wide or something like that. But I've eventually, over time, converted all of it to mostly native plants. But yeah, you can get in over your head when that bug bites you real quick, and then you realize, oh my gosh, I don't have the time, energy, or knowledge to really manage this problem I've given myself, and then it becomes more frustrating when it should be enjoyable.
That's true. Sometimes you want to tout native plants as being less work. I've not found that to be the case. Yeah. But what I have found to be the case is that the time I spend in my landscape with my native plants is time I cherish, and I have a lot of fun in it, because, you know, today I had a new butterfly in my yard that I haven't seen for a year that showed up. It tells me it's getting close to spring. You know, when I'm outside, I'm looking for things. I've got something to do. It's exciting. There's anticipation. When I don't have time in my yard because I've got to run off and teach or do something else, I get kind of grouchy. That's not the case with it. Typical yard, which might be really easy. I just mow it, or like my neighbors, I hire somebody to come by every couple of weeks or every week in the summer and mow it flat and they leave. That's simple, but it's boring. And I think the real benefit, or the reason to go native, is to make your life more interesting. And besides all the environmental things that help the rest of the world around us, but from a personal standpoint, from that selfish human anthropocentric point of view, it's just more interesting for me to have this native plant landscape wherever I've lived. I've made several.
Now, you mentioned about the environmental aspects of it. Let's explore that a little bit. Since they're natives, do they need any fertilizer at all?
Not if you put the right plant in the right place, Craig. You know, we have seen this huge decline in birds and insects, and I suspect just about everything else that people may not be as easily able to count. But I don't like love bugs very well. But in the old days, when I moved to Florida, I could not drive across the middle of the state to get to Vero Beach or something without having to stop once or twice to clean love bugs off my windshield. That hasn't happened to me in a number of years. I almost never get bugs splattering on my windshield. That tells me there just aren't that many flying bugs anymore. And the, you know, data from Europe and this country, at least in North America, I'm not sure what's happening in the rest of the world. I suspect it's similar, would show that there's been up to a 75% decline in the number of insects. And that is the foundation of the world's ecology, all the things that eat them that then eat things that eat bugs, you know, the birds, et cetera. And, you know, there's been a huge decline in the numbers of birds, just numbers, not as much species, but the numbers. And so we're seeing this huge decline worldwide. Florida has a relatively, once more, active acquisition program. It was so great when I first moved here. It still exists. We have about 25% of Florida set aside environmental lands. That's not enough to make up for all the other things we do as a species in the part that we live in. And so what we do in our yard has an impact. It really does. You know, it creates these stepping stones, this ability for migrating birds to do something in your yard, my yard, before they have to move to the next place. It creates places for pollinators to actually raise a family, so to speak, instead of just stopping by for a meal and then having to find a real place to live. What we do in our yards has significant impact, especially if, and it's a growing movement in the world around us, certainly a growing movement in Florida from what I've seen, more and more people adding these little stepping stones in this, what I call a you know, I live in a desert as far as landscaping goes. My little subdivision here in Pasco is just surrounded by people with yards that are nothing more than gravel and a tree or something. And Jesus, there is just nothing there. But what I can do in my yard has a big impact, because all of a sudden there is a oasis, so to speak, that feeds things, and I can produce things, certain bees and butterflies and all the rest of that. So yeah, I'm a huge proponent, believer, so to speak, in the impact of individual action, and there is a need for it.
Yeah, we discussed some of these topics on our butterfly episode, which folks can go back through the archives and listen to. And my connection to native plants largely comes through this prism of environmental activism. And I think if you look at the two huge global environmental threats facing humanity, and it's climate change and biodiversity collapse.
Yes.
And almost any aspect of that you pick out can be remedied to some extent, at least a solution is native plants, whether that's pollinators, whether it's birds, whether it's sea level rise, flooding mitigation. When I really became zealous about advocating for native plants, it's because every time I pulled at those threads and looked into solutions, all of them came back at some level to native plants.
Well, there is a connection, absolutely, in that our individual actions. You know, I think one of the biggest problems the environmental movement often has is this sky is falling thing that makes people feel powerless. You know, I'm all of a sudden feeling like the world is collapsing. I'm depressed and I'm impotent. I can't do anything about it except curl up in a corner and be despair. You know, it's what we do in our own yard. This gives us the power to actually do something. And what we do actually is important, even if it's small. I've always lived in Florida with a standard size lot. I don't have acres. I wish I did, but I don't. You know, I have seen huge changes in that little typical subdivision lot size in terms of wildlife value, what kinds of things come to depend on what I've done over the years. And all of us working together can make that difference. Yeah. And it's simple and it's fun.
Yeah. The Jeff Vandermeer.
Yes.
Vandermeer episode also talks about rewilding your yard. And I've told this story before as well, in that, you know, it's early 2020, lockdown, world's falling apart, wildfires in Australia. I mean, the whole thing is Trump pandemic, you name it. I came to wildflowers as, this is something I can do today. I can plant native flowers, and I can do my little patch. And that is, it took these enormous global national challenges of which I have no ability to influence, and put it into my own backyard. And that's how I was able to kind of come to terms in my own head with, what can I do? I think a lot of people, what can I do? How can I help these problems are so big? You know, what can I do about fossil fuel economy and extraction and any of this kind of stuff? Well, that's one thing you can do today. You can put some native plants in your yard. It is not going to change the world, but 10 million of us doing it, and that snowball starts to get going, and that will have an impact in your yard to the world.
It's true. Absolutely. That snowball, you know, when I first moved to Florida about 35 years ago, and I would go and speak and do the kinds of things I was doing with that urban wildlife program, getting any size audience to just about anything I was doing, getting a horticulture extension agent to invite me in to speak to their county. I had three or four people that understood what I was trying to do. And I had 20 counties. I probably had 15 to more that never invited me to do anything because they couldn't understand what I was all about or felt like maybe their county audience wasn't there for it. That's not true anymore. And it is, you know, just look at how many Facebook groups are out there of people that are interested and want more information on wildflowers, on native plants, on all those issues that we've talked about now. It is a growing movement, and my ability to reach more people with the messages I'm trying to give is increased greatly.
Exciting news for Welcome to Florida as we welcome a new sponsor, and it's the James Museum of Western and Wildlife Art there in St. Petersburg. And throughout the year, we're going to be telling you about upcoming exhibitions at the James, and beginning January 28th and running through March 16th, 2022, the James Museum of Western and Wildlife Art presents Away From Home, American Indian Boarding School Stories. Now, the American Indian boarding school era in America, which lasted from the late 1800s into the mid 1900s, was one of the darkest chapters in American history. Native American children taken from their families, forcibly removed from their reservations and homelands. Their names were changed. Their hair was cut. They were forced out of their traditional dress and were forcibly assimilated into white culture. And at the James Museum of Western and Wildlife Art, this new exhibition, Away From Home, American Indian Boarding School Stories, shares that time through historical photographs, objects, interviews. It's a heartbreaking but necessary lesson in American history and the attempted genocide of Native American culture through public education. You can see it from January 28th through March 16th at the James Museum of Western and Wildlife Art in St. Petersburg.
What do you have planted in your yard? What native plants appeal to you?
That's a great question, but it's almost impossible to answer. I'll start off by saying I rent this house. So okay. Some people think I'm really eccentric and a little bit even further out there than eccentric because I'm spending so much time, energy, et cetera, on a house I don't own that I probably will move from someday. So, okay. But while I'm here, I get this huge amount of enjoyment for what I do. It's worth every minute, every dollar, and it doesn't cost me a fortune. So answer your question more specifically, I laid out a plot in my front yard. First thing I did, you know, my front yard was all grass of various kinds of lawn grass and various quality anyhow. And I laid that out and I killed off the grass. I did it mostly with a spade. I didn't use herbicides. Not that that's always a bad thing to do, but I didn't. And then I waited for the weeds to come up because I'll tell you the first thing that happens in Florida when you disturb the surface in a typical yard is just weeds, nothing you really want. So many people I see on Facebook groups just want to kill off their grass and then look at what comes up and decide if it's native or not. If it's native, I'll leave it. It's like, no, that doesn't work. So, you know, I had a plan for what I wanted to put in there and I grew a lot of it myself from seeds I've collected from over time, this and that, a few nursery plants and collecting seeds from those. And I planted my front yard. It's a wildflower meadow. It's got native grasses and about 20 or 30 different species of wildflowers. And they bloom as long a blooming season. You know, if you're going to put in a wildflower, quote, meadow for butterflies and bees and other pollinators, you've got to use some native grasses because a meadow is more grass than wildflower. And you want to have things that have different kinds of flowers blooming at different times of year. So you've always got some food there from spring through really late fall into early winter. And so that's what I did. I've got about 30 or 40 species of wildflowers in there. And then I started tackling the back and I created a small part of my backyard as a deciduous woodland. And I chose those plants partly to be pollinator friendly and partly to provide food for birds. So, you know, I've got live oaks in my yard. There's a gentleman that I won't name that, you know, has written a book about the value of oaks. And that's true. The oaks can be useful, but I didn't need an oak. My neighbors have oaks. So, you know, why would I put something like an oak in my yard? I don't need it. So I put a different deciduous shade tree and it's getting bigger. Someday it'll be a shade tree. Right now it's just kind of a really tall sapling. And it's a basswood. I like basswood. It's a great great honey plant where I'm from in Wisconsin. It grows down into this part of central Florida naturally. And so it's a good bee plant and it produces food for birds. And it's the foundation of my woods and it loses leaves in the winter. So everything now is in full sun. And that's really important for my understory trees and shrubs, my native azaleas, and a few other things that need sun for part of the year and then protection from too much sun the rest of the year. Deciduous plants are really useful and they throw the leaves onto the ground and that fertilizes the soil beneath it. It creates conditions for all these invertebrates besides earthworms, which technically aren't native, for all the birds that are looking for that. So, you know, I created this little woodland and I have a wide variety of trees and shrubs in this thing. And then I made a couple of wet areas in my yard, which I talk about in my blog, and recently put a little scrub in there because there's some scrub. So I have a variety of different landscape approaches, so to speak, throughout the yard I've got. And because I'm renting, I have to keep some of the grass, or my landlords would kick me out. They said, please, Craig, don't make it's really nice what you did, but don't make it any bigger. So I whittle away at it in small little increments, but I do have to leave some grass. But that's not the end of the world. I do what I can, I guess. And that's what anybody, whether you live in an HOA, whether you've got restrictions on what you can do, none of those things tell you you can't do something. It might limit the extent of what you can do, but even what I'm doing here, which is not my entire yard, it was in my old place, and it would be if I could. Even what we've done here has made this huge difference. I mean, when I first moved here, I had a key lime given to me as a housewarming gift, and I had to hand pollinate it. There was not a single bee ever in my yard for the first few months that would have pollinated anything. It was just a desert. There was no reason for a bee to live here, even the common honeybees. And of course, that's not true anymore. And it changed pretty dramatically within that first year, even within the first 6 months, about the number of species of bees and butterflies that all of a sudden showed up in my yard, but live here, prosper here, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Do you have a favorite type of native plant that you planted in both places?
Well, those are good questions too, but you know, it's like saying, you know, do you have a favorite child? I wouldn't tell you if I did. yeah, there are things I like best. If you're planting wildflowers, the best wildflowers overall are things in the aster family, but there's hundreds of those. You know, I think the first plant that I ever recognized as a flower when I was a little kid, my grandpa took me out to the country. It's now part of Madison, but it was in the country. It was a wildflower farm, and we bought some cut wildflowers for my godmother, and it was black-eyed Susans. I remember that distinctly. So I've always had a fondness for black-eyed Susan. It's a common wildflower. It grows all over the nation, pretty much. The ones that grow in Florida were pretty unique, even though it's the same species from something you might buy from a Burpee catalog or Prairie Moon Nursery in Minnesota. They just won't survive here, but our Florida native black-eyed Susans are super easy, and I've got a fondness for those. You know, I love fringe tree as a tree. I'm not quite sure why, but every place I've lived in Florida, I've planted a fringe tree. I just get a giant kick out of it when it's in full bloom. And I'm always tempted when it's going to bloom to call up all my friends and have a party and invite them out there so they can see my fringe tree. It's kind of silly in a way, but I get excited when I see it getting ready to flower. It's just such a beautiful tree. And it lasts.
Uh-oh, Craig's having over another fringe tree party.
Gotcha. But my fringe tree is too little right now. I got to wait another year or so before we can have that party. I'll invite you guys.
What can you tell us about the Florida Roadside Wildflower Program? I know a lot of people probably see the Department of Transportation signs as they drive around the state. That is a program through the Department of Transportation. Tell us a little bit about that program and its how it works and its efficacy.
You start out by trying to envision how many linear miles of roadside exist in Florida. It'd be phenomenal. Wrap your brain around how many miles of roads we've got, and each one of them has a roadside, and they both got them on both sides. And so there's a lot of land area that's tied up in roadsides, and some of them have been hugely disturbed and don't really harbor much of native whatever, but a lot of them, especially in North Florida and in when you get into the country parts of Florida through Central Florida, et cetera, there's a lot of native vegetation in there that traditionally has been mowed routinely because, you know, DOT is tasked with keeping roadways safe and people feel uncomfortable if they have to drive off the road from an accident or from a car malfunction or whatever it might be into a dense jungle of stuff. So they have to mow some of the edge, but they don't really have to mow all of it to make roadways safe. So, you know, the Florida Wildflower Foundation, which I've been active with since its inception, especially in North Florida, have developed this roadside program. Eleanor Dietrich has done such a great job and passed it on to people since she's retired. And, you know, because each DOT has its own district and a district manager with a different approach and a different belief in what their job responsibilities are, but worked closely with those folks to try to limit mowing. And it's made a huge difference in North Florida, especially if you drive through Apalachicola National Forest, you will see some, and there's a lot of really rare and listed endangered threatened plants growing on those roadsides that now are able to flower and produce seed before they get mowed in the fall. There's no reason really to mow it more than maybe once or twice a year to limit the amount of woody plants that might come in. So it's been a great program. You know, there's always bugs and places, not bugs in terms of insects, but things that go bump in the night that need to be fixed that aren't going perfectly. They're managers that are more enthusiastic than others, but it's worked pretty well. It hasn't, you know, extended into a lot of the rest of Florida the way I wish it would, but that hopefully will come over time.
Say I'm just starting out with the idea of putting native plants in my yard. Where would I get the seeds from? Where's the best place?
That's a good question. First of all, I get so many requests, you know, because I do have this little goofy nursery of mine, and I write that blog, et cetera, a couple blogs actually. And people write me and wonder where they can get seeds. Like, doing seeds is going to be faster, cheaper, et cetera. And frankly, it's the worst way to start, because just scatter, you know, where I'm from in Wisconsin, I could create a little open area. I could buy a bunch of seeds and I'll pick on Prairie Moon. What a great native plant nursery it is. And in Minnesota, I could buy a bunch of wildflowers from them and I could sow those seeds in that open dirt and I'd get reasonable success. But in Florida, I've never found it to be very successful because we have so many weeds. And so every time I've opened up any place and I've worked in bigger projects than just my yard, I've spent years trying to control the weeds that have come up. So just throwing seeds out there that then have to fight with all the seeds of weeds that are going to come up and probably overwhelm them is not always as easy approach. But there is this group called the Florida Wildflower Cooperative, and they supply bulk seed to DOT for all the roadside plantings they've done. Because I didn't mention that they have planted a bunch of roadsides with wildflowers to, quote, beautify things, but there's ecological value in it too. So they do provide seeds, but there is a whole group of nursery people, I should say, a lot of great women, that through the Florida Association of Native Nurseries called FAN. And those nurseries sell plants. You know, I've always found it easiest, unless I'm, you know, even on a fairly big project, to buy some plants, put them into clusters and allow them to then reseed, having the patience to wait a few years. Because if you try to plant a big area with plants, you're going to spend a huge amount of money. And sometimes people will say, God, Craig, you must have a lot of money to do what you do. It's like, no, I don't have. Jesus, I teach college. It's not the way to become rich. But I have always bought 4 or 5 plants, planted them, collected the seed, either let the seed fall into the area or collect the seed and grow it in a flat. And then I've got dozens of plants the next year and I can plant those in over a year or two. I can plant a bigger area than what I could afford to do. And the seeds are important, but they've come from the plants I've started with. I've always found that to be the most efficacious approach to this whole thing. And not just buying seeds, not buying seeds and planting them in a flat and then putting my plants out after they come up. That's also another way to do it. But just simply scattering seed in open soil in most of the places that I've lived in Florida just has failed abysmally.
I will put links to the Florida Wildflower Cooperative, Florida Great. Association of Native Nurseries, and the Florida Native Plant Society in the show notes. All three are good Great. Resources for people, not only for acquiring material, but also education as well. And you know, all of what you've talked about, different light conditions, different temperature conditions, different soil conditions. I want to reaffirm what you said. There is a popular misconception that planting natives is easy. You stick them in the ground and they grow. That's not the case. They require less water and fertilizer and all that stuff when established, but they are not maintenance-free plants by any stretch of the imagination.
No, it takes some work and some management. But, you know, people have to understand that in the natural world, natural lands are managed by nature. You know, we have things like wildfires and we have other kinds of management things that occur in nature that keep systems healthy or in the condition they're in. Or, you know, a wildflower prairie is going to turn into a woods if it never burns. That's why Kissimmee Prairie is one of the most amazing state parks in the state. But they burn it every couple of years because otherwise it would start to sprout all kinds of oaks and other things and it wouldn't be a prairie anymore. That's what happened in nature. Most people don't have the luxury of burning their yard with a propane torch. I'm always tempted to do that. But you know, it has to be managed to some extent. We have to keep the weeds out, especially in the first few years, and give your plants a chance to become better established. You may have to water them in periods of a drought until they get established. I don't fertilize. I do mulch some of my woodland areas with leaf litter, and that is organic fertilization. But I don't fertilize my wildflower beds ever, but I sometimes do have to water them during periods of excessive drought or during establishment. And that, but work, there's always something to do. But all the people I know that are involved with this, including myself, I find that the work I put in is satisfying, it's fun, I enjoy it. I mean, it's work, but and frankly, it's so much easier to hire a lawn guy to mow your yard and you can watch the game and have a beer and life is easy, but geez, it's boring. So most people I know that get into this enjoy the time they spend in their yard, their little communion with their plants and the butterflies, bees, birds, whatever, that's also all of a sudden now occupying a place that was sterile. It's enjoyable, but it's work.
Yeah, you get that first zebra longwing in the yard, you get that first monarch chrysalis that comes out, the effort is worth it. When you have those experiences, it really is. Last one from me. We asked this to so many of our guests. How is climate change impacting Florida's native wildflowers?
Oof, good question. You know, I mean, I teach about climate change in my University of Tampa class on environmental studies. I don't think there's any reasoned human being that would argue that the climate is changing. There's so many people arguing about why and whether we should worry about it. What can we do? How fast we got to move? But the climate's changing. And very few people, except folks that have their head underground, are not aware that it's changing. So what is happening? You know, one of the things that is obvious to me anyhow is that flowering plants are blooming at different times than they traditionally have. You know, that thing called phenology, the timing of things. And people I know that are working on those kind of issues that are documenting when the first of this blooms and the first of that bloom, they're seeing in the last several decades that overall, trees and shrubs, flowering trees and shrubs, which is 85% of all the plants on Earth now are flowering plants, are blooming earlier than normal. Now, is that a problem? It is and it isn't, because flowering plants almost always require pollinators to pollinate them to set seed or fruit. All the things that we eat, except for things like Brussels sprouts, are result of pollination, and the pollinators aren't necessarily active just because the plants are blooming. And then the birds that are migrating up from the tropics, where a lot of our birds spend their time, have no idea what the temperature is here. You know, they're gauging the thing that isn't changing, and that's daylight. And so it's time to migrate. But by the time they get here, the plants are done flowering, the pollinators they might have eaten are done pollinating, and they're caught off guard. So, you know, will they evolutionarily, will they adapt and adjust? Maybe they will. Climate change is affecting the phenology of blooms. The other thing it's obviously affecting is our weather patterns. You know, when I first came to Florida, I was always told by so many, almost everybody I knew that was living here, that it rains every afternoon. We get a short thunderstorm. Well, that is not the case anymore. You know, we'll go days in the summer. It'll be 93 and everything is getting dry and it didn't rain. It didn't rain. It didn't rain 3-4 days in a row. That's not what I remember from when I came here 35 years ago. When it rains, it's often is heavier. There's more impact to it. It's pounding us. And those kinds of weather patterns where you have drought and then you have excessive moisture, you have hurricanes that are stronger, that are certainly affecting our natural communities. All those kinds of things are the result of climate change. And so is freeze. You know, people think we're in this global warming, and overall, the average globe is warming it. A little less than a degree here and there, up to several degrees over time. That's super significant. But it doesn't preclude the fact that we also get freak cold weather. We haven't had that here in a while, but it's not precluded by climate change. We just see more intense events than what we've seen in the past. And that certainly has an impact on plants that are dependent on climate conditions to survive. And so many of Florida's native plants have fairly narrow growing requirements. Yeah. You know, that's why we have such a diversity of things. We have very few plants that occur statewide everywhere. And some of them only occur here and there, and they're dependent on really specific soil moisture, temperature conditions. And that's changing. It may affect a lot of species and their ability to hang on. In Florida, they've been hanging on since the last ice age. Maybe some of those will just disappear. We're seeing it with Florida torreya trees, for example, or torreya trees, I should say. You know, there's a couple in North Carolina that are growing really well. They're not growing in Florida very well at all anymore. And that kind of thing may become more common over time.
Last question for me, mulch or no mulch? And do you endorse pine straw as a substitute?
Mulch. Boy, that's another good question, Craig. I think it really depends on your goals and what kind of plants you're trying to grow. I mean, pine straw is a good mulch because it lets moisture through, but it also breathes. It's not good to use any mulch real thick. People have this idea that mulch is somehow a beautification project. Like, my mulch is beautiful. I'm going to go to the store and buy something beautiful and just mulch it. And I'm going to sit back and my neighbors are going to love me because I have this beautiful mulched everything with these bushes popping out of it. You know, mulches in nature decompose and provide really important nutrients to the plants that are growing in it. And so I like to use mulches that decay rather quickly, and I can get more, you know, because my little woods drops leaves every winter and those leaves decay. Live oak leaves are really thick, so they don't decay as fast as a laurel oak, for example, or a Schumard, which is even better in my opinion, which all grow here in this part of the world really well. I like to use organic mulches that decay. I really detest mulches that are woody that are not supposed to decay because it defeats everything and it really hurts the life of the soil beneath it that plants count on. If you're growing wildflowers, though, you don't really want much for mulch because you want those mostly tiny seeds to hit the soil surface and be able to emerge and grow and increase the number of plants you've got over time. And if you're going to mulch at all in a place with wildflowers, you're going to want to mulch lightly with something that has some space. Pine straw can work if it's not dense. I tend not to mulch my wildflower areas at all on purpose. In a place like Kissimmee, that all that dead grass and stuff that accumulates over time burns off because they burn it, and that nutrient gets released back to the soil. In my wildflower meadow, I got to dethatch those grasses with a little hand rake or something to keep it more open. And last but not least, you know, the vast majority, we have over 300 native bees in Florida, 2/3 or more of them nest in open ground. And so when we, you know, they're not honeybees, they aren't colonial, they're not nesting like a carpenter bee would and decaying wood, and they're nesting in bare soil. And so when we cover up our soil too densely, we preclude the ability of some of those really cool green metallic bees and a variety of other really cool native bees from being able to produce offspring and live out their life. And, you know, I think that's really the goal for native plant landscaping, is not to attract things, but to create habitats so they can survive, raise young, and move on in through the future with you. And that happens by having some bare soil areas. And I've been touting that for a long time. You know, there are places that mulch makes sense, and there's places where one kind of mulch, like a walkway, might make sense to use something that doesn't decay. But there's also a real need in parts of a good landscape, especially one where pollinators are important, to leave some bare soil. bare sand. Create a pile of open sand. Buy a bunch of play sand or some builder sand at a local supply place like Lowe's and create a little pile of openness and just let it be open. That can be really useful.
Craig Hegel, thank you so much for the time. Links to the books, the blog. You can follow him on Instagram, as I just did today, at Craig Hegel. That's spelled CraigHuegel on Instagram. Thank you so much for the time today.
It's been enlightening. Thank you again.
Talking to you guys. It's always it's fun. Thanks, Craig.
Do you have native plants or wildflowers in your yard, Craig?
I have some butterfly attractors in out there. When we first moved in, because I thought this was what you were supposed to do, I tried putting out St. Augustine grass and it just, it died. It just died because we've got two huge oak trees in our front yard and there was too much shade. And, you know, I'm not going to get rid of the oaks. That's for sure. So.
Well, you were up here with me on Amelia Island recently and I spared you the experience of me walking you through our little native plant and wildflower landscape and pointing out all the porterweed and the firecracker plant and the black-eyed Susans and the milkweed and the saw palmetto and everything else, the salvia that we've got in there. But as I've mentioned on this episode and numerous others, I'm a huge advocate for native plants and wildflowers and their benefits to the environment. And I can't encourage people enough, if you've got an interest, explore it, start small and see what you can find. And I want to thank you again for coming up here, Craig, to have the book signing at Story and Song, and was happy fun to be able to help you check a few items off your Florida bucket list.
Absolutely. Well, and of course, also we got to hear the group Friction Farm perform a song they had written based on Oh Florida, which was pretty funny.
Yeah. But we got to see American Beach, the tallest dune in Florida, Nana Dune, the oldest bar in Florida, the Palace Saloon downtown. We went to the marina, went to Fort Clinch State Park, and that reminds us of our episode from last week about state parks. And in addition to Fort Clinch, Eric Draper, the outgoing executive director of the Florida State Parks, mentioned a number of parks in Sarasota, and Visit Sarasota does sponsor this episode. We talked about Myakka River State Park, talked about Oscar Scheer State Park.
Well, let me just mention the, you know, the, a lot of the state parks, when they were built back in the 30s by the Civilian Conservation Corps, they thought the Florida native plants were ugly and did their best to get rid of them and instead bring in exotic plants like birds of paradise and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So now the state parks are in the process of trying to undo that damage that was originally done. So.
And two of those great state parks are in Sarasota County, Myakka River, Oscar Scheer. Visit Sarasota.com to learn more, find out about the outdoor activities. There's canoeing, there's kayaking, bird watching, eco tours out on the bay, all kinds of stuff for you to see and do in Sarasota County. Visit Sarasota.com.
And this is a great time of year to go do that stuff too. It's, you know, it's in the mid 60s, so you don't really have to worry about mosquitoes. It's a great time to go out and do a lot of that outdoor stuff.
Welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.